I don't know if you remember when you were in Minneapolis last year.
Yes.
Okay, we did that. People are still talking about that panel discussion and about this speech you gave.
Oh, well, it was a great couple of days,
yeah,
wasn't it?
I thought it was. I know you do a lot of that. Does it always go so well?
Not always, no.
Yeah.
So that was very nice. It was particularly nice.
Well, this is a very civilized community out in the middle of America.
Yes.
Oh, Mitch, I'm playing with my watch. Is that what you're hearing? Okay. I think, should we just get going here?
Let's just do it and see how we get on.
Well, I can't remember where we were with the program now, but now we launched this program called Speaking of Faith as a weekly national program in the summer. We're growing. We're on in over 50 markets now. We're on in 6 of the top 10 markets. We're in New York and Los Angeles and Washington and good places. And it's called Speaking of Faith. And so I say that I let religious people speak in religious ways. Mm-hmm. And what I thought I'd like to do with you today in terms of your new book is trace not so much your life story, but focus in on how your theology developed in that life story and let that mm-hmm. be how we focus our conversation.
Okay. That sounds good.
And I'll
yes.
and I'll I'm the one who asked the question, so it's up to me to make that happen. I know my
you're
job.
You're only as good as your interviewer.
So I want to start again. You know, I don't want to spend. I also had read previously your first memoir, mm-hmm. so I had read that, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on your time. In the religious order, but we obviously have to start there. And so what the way I thought I would just put that question as we begin is, how do you think now about how that experience limited your theology?
I think there wasn't very much theology involved in my convent years. We rather took the idea of God for granted as a being who would listen, who was present, who'd somehow made the world and who had appeared on earth in Jesus Christ. And we were introduced to a little theology, but not very much. I think the limiting factor was the lifestyle, because we were not encouraged to think or explore. Obedience was the key. And we had to, in common with most religious orders at that time, we were supposed to be subservient to our superiors, seeing them in the place of God.
Right.
And not following your own thoughts through or exploring ideas or expressing doubt or confusion, because your job was not to reason why, yours but to do and die. I mean, we were supposed to be soldiers of Christ and obey as implicitly as soldiers obey their commanding officer.
Right. It is ironic, though, because all of those practices and structures presumably had been created with the object that you would become closer to God through living that way.
That's true. But then many of these practices had congealed over the centuries. Mm-hmm. I mean, and so that what had been appropriate when in the 19th century, when my order was founded, was not appropriate for girls in the early 1960s. And the Vatican Council was meeting as I entered.
Right.
And they were going to change the religious life and demand that people brought some of these practices up to date, jettison some of the older practices, which had got stuck in a cultural limbo, as it were. And so we were being asked to behave as though we were Victorian women, when, in fact, we had moved on, and there was nothing holy, particularly, for example, about always speaking in a very low voice, laughing in a restrained trill, only taking a bath once a week. There's nothing sacred about it. But because these things had congealed and become cast in stone, they had become sacralized in some way. So we had an awful lot of cultural lumber to deal with. Very hard for girls in the early 60s to behave like Victorian ladies.
You know, and there's something that feels sad and almost tragic, you know, reading your accounts of that, because you did have a spiritual longing. I mean, you were young, it was undefined in many ways, but it seems almost like the structures of that religious life got completely in the way.
It could do. Now, I was also privileged to meet with some nuns who had been able to work with these structures and who'd done it. They were wise. They were benevolent. They were compassionate. They were even funny. They were mature, full human beings, and they were holy people. But I knew that I wasn't going to be like that. I was going to be one of the, sadly, rather more common variety of nun who was taking back little satisfactions here and there. I was much too young, really, I think, to make that kind of momentous choice. I was only 17 when I entered the convent, and I was basically a child. And I had lots of inchoate yearnings, and I was hoping for transfiguration. I was hoping for God to invade my life and that I would become sort of holy and wise and serene, a sort of Buddha, perhaps even a saint. And it would all happen fairly quickly. And of course, it didn't happen like that at all. So it's not that the structures infallibly kept people from God. There were some very holy nuns in there.
Right.
And they became a kind of marker to me, because when I realized that I wasn't of that caliber, then I realized I had to leave.
And even though by the time you left, it almost sounds, as you tell the story, like there was no choice. You know, you describe that leaving as a form of exile that entailed spiritual dislocation as well as physical dislocation.
I lost my orientation because being a nun at that time was not like training to be a teacher or a broadcaster or a doctor, where you learn a skill, but your deepest self remains and personal life remains intact and unaffected. This training was meant to be a conditioning that was designed to last a lifetime, and it did. And when I left the convent, I did not know how to live without these structures. I felt the whole tenor of my life had changed, and with this, and yet I was still the same. I was still basically a nun, but in secular clothes. And I needed to train myself to become a secular as rigorously as I had trained myself to become a nun. But of course, I didn't have much guidance with that. I think a few years later, when there had been many more people who had left the religious life, they set up help centres and advisory and consultants, because they realised that this was a trauma. It was like somebody who's been in a sect, for example, and needs to be, as it were, debriefed and sort of helped back to ordinary world, or unconditioned, as it were, deconditioned. And I needed something like that.
I'm sort of intrigued by that word you use, becoming a secular. It's in the book also.
We always referred to people who were not nuns as seculars.
Yeah.
And secular means world. They belong to the world, and we did not. We were encouraged to reject the world in a way at a very profound level, not rejecting the people in it or anything of that sort, but rejecting the worldly ethos, where you know you're out to make money, self gain, self establishment, self advertisement, pleasure, etc. All that we were subverting and going towards a more spiritual interior life, as we thought, and so. basically I'd been trained to reject this world. Mm-hmm. And then there I was in the middle of it, having to relate to it. And that was very hard.
And I mean, even in that terminology, it almost seems to make inevitable what happened, which is that when you left the religious order and became a secular, you were truly a secular person, that there was not a, very quickly no spiritual dimension really to your life in the world.
Well, not only that, I'd been a complete flop at spirituality in the convent.
Felt, right?
I mean, I hadn't found it almost impossible to pray. And that was clearly a bit of a drawback for a nun. I used to go into meditation every single morning at 6 o'clock, and we'd have to meditate for an hour, and I could not do it. I could not keep my mind on my prayer for more than 2 minutes. My mind would go skittering off, or else be sunk in a sort of sloth of boredom and torpor and sleep, because I was an adolescent and longing for sleep, and getting up at bed at 5:30 was just awful. Other people seemed to be getting on better than me. And however hard I tried, I could not pray. And God remained utterly distant and elusive. The heavens remained closed. And I don't know quite what I thought should be happening. I knew I couldn't expect voices or visions, because these were only for very special people and were often regarded as suspect indeed. But I expected something, or at least that I would myself be caught up in my prayer. And we spent a great deal of time in silence. And the idea was that, you know, this silence would help you to focus solely on God. But my mind could not remain on God. I seemed allergic to God, in a sense. So that when I finally left the religious life, I tried to stay in the Catholic Church, and did for a few years. But God eventually fell away. Even though I tried to make him the centre of my life, he'd remained impossibly distant. And he'd always been absent. So the next step was that really he didn't exist. He had never really existed for me, as I thought.
Mm. So you know, there's something about the life of the mind in your story. I mean, you talk about your mind skittering off, but really you found some salvation in your intellect, didn't you? Or a gift in that, although I don't know if you, did you recognize it as a gift early on?
Well, in the convent, we didn't use it much.
Yeah.
But we spent most of our time sewing and cleaning and scrubbing, chores that I detest to this day, and had rather hoped to enter a convent to avoid, unlike I didn't want to be an endless housewife. But when I got to Oxford University, then this was pure delight to be able to read again. But there was something wrong. And before I'd entered the religious life, I had been in love with literature and poetry. When I read a poem, my whole self would jump out to greet it. You know, I was moved, touched within, and lifted above myself, just wrapped up in it. But now, when I came, I could do everything intellectually. I could construct arguments. One of my friends said my essays were like Gothic cathedrals, with all kinds of ideas of various critics fitted neatly together into an intricate structure. But none of myself was going into it. And I found it almost impossible to have a fresh idea, an original response, or my own response to a poem, unless I found that somebody else was there first to tell me what to do, some other critic or some other teacher to tell me what to think. Because for years, every time I'd had an idea of my own, I'd quashed it and stamped down on it, because we weren't supposed to have these ideas. And very often my ideas were a bit subversive in the convent. You know, I've had doubts about the existence of God. I had doubts about the efficacy of prayer. I had doubts about the wisdom of the system, all of which I had to quash, because the whole purpose of the training was that we would eventually see the sense of some of the wisdom behind some of these customs and practices and beliefs when we became spiritually mature. But I went around telling myself black was white and white was black, and I think basically I damaged my brain, not neurologically,
no, but
that I deflected it from its healthy bias towards seeing things as they are. And so there was, just as in the convent, there had been a gaping hole at the centre of my spiritual life in my inability to pray or to think or relate to God. So in my intellectual life at Oxford, even though I could do it all with ideas and did very well along as I could, there was the inner core of response was not present. And I was not having the kind of original ideas or fresh ideas or ideas that I'd thought of myself in the way that I'd been able to do once and that I could see that my fellow students could do.
And that went on for quite some time, didn't it?
It was a long time, it was about 2 or 3 years before it started to come back. And the first moment when it came back was when I heard a lecturer reading T.S. Eliot's poem Ash Wednesday,
yes,
which you'll find at the beginning of my book.
Take a sort of a framing.
It's the spine of the book.
Yes,
it's the spine of the book. That poem. It's meant a great deal to me on my journey. So it was as soon as Dame Helen Gardner, a great professor of Oxford in my day, started to read this poem in her wonderful way. And started to explain it, to expound it, I felt that answering response because it seemed to be speaking directly to my condition. And thereafter, intermittently, I found myself being able to think again, to respond again, to slowly, to have fresh ideas. But it did take a time. I think you have to be very careful about how you train young people to be faithful in religion. What does faith mean? I think it must mean, as all the great masters tell you, see things as they really are. The Buddha said that. He was most emphatic about it. Never take other people's word for it. Never take second-hand ideas. Buddha used to tell his monks, if you don't like my teaching, all right, don't follow it. If it doesn't speak to you, if it doesn't work for you, we'll find something else. And that ability to see things as they are is crucial. You cannot start your religious quest telling yourself that black was white or things that are clearly not so are so, or telling yourself you have no doubts about doctrines when you do have doubts. Otherwise, you can distort the quality of your thinking.
And there is also something at the heart of Buddhist thought was also seeing suffering and embracing suffering. And there's you are very candid in your memoir, in your new book, about physical trauma that you had, which was eventually diagnosed as epilepsy, but went undiagnosed and, I think, misdiagnosed. Maybe physical effects of this kind of dislocation you're describing. And it was sort of interesting to me when the chapter you took from Ash Wednesday that you entitled Consequently I Rejoice, begins in some of your darkest times in that
yes.
period after you left the convent. But you tell me what that line evoked for you in that context.
Well, this poem, as you say, came to me at one of the darker times of my life when I really thought I was losing my mind. Because apart from all my difficulties about leaving the convent, I also had this undiagnosed illness, which actually comes from brain damage. I was slightly brain damaged probably at birth. There's a lesion on my brain. It needed physical treatment, and I was it was assumed that it was purely psychosomatic, and I went to see psychiatrists, and nothing worked. And this illness is very frightening, mm-hmm. especially if you don't know where it is. You'd go somewhere or do something, and you'd be unaware of what you were doing.
Right, you're having blackouts.
Moments of crippling terror. Mm-hmm. Crippling fear. Some people call it the death fear because it's what some people have when they are approaching death, because their brain is in turmoil, in neurologically, electrically in turmoil, and so I really thought I was losing my mind. That having rejected the world, I was now incapable of living in it, that I had damaged myself in the convent in some way, in some irreparable way that nobody could cure, and that I would finish my life in a locked ward. Eventually, though, I gave up. I said to myself, look, I'm not going to get help. I called for help in various ways, and people kept telling me I was doing fine. And still, the thing it was the diagnosis of epilepsy was still years in the future. And I said, the thing I've got to do now is accept this malady and take it as something that's just going to be a part of my life, and learn to roll with it as though I was on a terrifying roller coaster ride, and not fight against it anymore, not expect people to help me because they obviously couldn't help me. And the first line of T.S. Eliot's poem is, because I do not hope to turn again, right. Because I do not hope. And so and it was just after I'd made this decision to stop expecting help that this poem came to me with such force. And I thought to myself, well, look, it's already starting to work. I have given up hope, and I'm beginning to get my feeling for poetry back. and therefore, the centre of that poem is when Eliot says, because I do not hope to turn again, consequently, I rejoice, right. Having to construct something upon which to rejoice. And it seemed to me that now my project was, if I couldn't get joy spontaneously anymore, I was going to have to construct my my well-being and my life, and even try to manufacture joy as carefully as an engineer will put together an aeroplane or a piece of intricate technology. This was to be my project. And Wordsworth, too, in his great ode on the intimations of immortality, regrets the passing of the joy that he had so easily and spontaneously as a young man. And he says, you know, all right, that's gone, but we will grieve not, rather find strength in what remains behind. Here, take what you've got and work with that. Don't go hankering for things that you can't have. At that time, I thought I couldn't have health. I couldn't have whole mental integrity and wholeness. Therefore, I had to work with what I'd got, which was still a great deal. After all, I was studying at one of the best universities in the world.
Right.
I was immensely privileged compared to the vast numbers of people on this planet. So to go with what I'd got and try and construct a viable lifestyle out of that, giving up hope of some salvation coming at me from without, outside myself.
It's really a moment of surrender, isn't it?
Yes, it is a moment of surrender. And that image of the roller coaster is quite a good one. When you're on it, there's nothing you can do. You've just got to go with it and give up fighting and moaning and groaning about your maladies or deformities. And it was a moment of surrender where you almost throw up your hands and say, all right, I give in. This is it. And things did take a turn for the better after that. They really did.
But I, you know, you're very clear, and you repeat this many times, that at this point, I think you well and truly did not consider yourself to be a religious person at all, that God was no longer part of your equation.
Yes, I struggled on with the Catholic Church for a while, but for a while I used to go to Mass at the Dominican monastery in Oxford called Blackfriars, and the Dominicans were very intelligent men, and they kept me in the church, I think, for longer than I would have been otherwise. When I moved to London, that was the end of it. I mean, I just never went near a church again. I felt exhausted by the whole religious enterprise. I wanted nothing to do with it. God, I would describe myself as atheist. I felt not anger, but just simple exhaustion from the whole thing. If I saw somebody reading a religious book on a train or something, I'd wince to myself, think, oh, fancy, you know, giving your mind to this stuff. And, of course, in London, in England, that was the mainstream view.
Right.
So for once, England is a very, very secular country, mm-hmm. and militantly secular, in fact. And so for once in my life, I was mainstream.
That's right. You'd become part of that world.
I'd become completely in the flow of things. I was fashionable. and people were longing to hear funny tales of the convent, you know. And I would tell them. And they would look at me with astonishment and say, how did you put up with that rubbish for all that time? Thank goodness you're out of there. Mm. And I would often say to myself, since I gave up God and religion, I've been so much happier. And that, I thought, was that.
Well, and then it is fascinating that as you began to approach religion again, as really as a subject that was part of your career, you started to do some television work. And in fact, you were setting out on this series with the goal of debunking religion. Is that fair?
Yes, no, absolutely. People say, well, how did you get into television? Well, a series of utter career disasters. And I think this is important, too, because everything I turned my hand to failed for all these years. I mean, I failed my PhD, so I couldn't be an English literature professor. My health was so bad, even after the epilepsy was diagnosed, that I lost my school teaching job. And then I'd written my first book by that time, my first memoir, Through the Narrow Gate, because I was slightly uneasy about the whole of these convent years just becoming a fund of funny stories to tell at dinner parties.
Right.
And I wanted to recover that time. And because people had seen me publicising this book, they offered me work in television after my teaching career had collapsed. And this was a new television channel opening up. The commissioning editor for religion was a passionate atheist who loathed religion. And he said he wanted to discuss religion as with the same rigour as every other subject.
Which was to tear it apart.
I was a major weapon in his anti-religious arsenal. But he was also very controversial series called Jesus the Evidence, which was actually at the beginning of the series going to actually blow up a life-size statue of Jesus, you know, as this was going to be the end of the whole thing. And I felt it wasn't just that I was being cynical. I felt that I was a woman with a mission, that people should see the harm that religion had done over the years. People should be liberated from feeling that they should believe impossible doctrines, and that I would show them that this was bonkers. And the word bonkers came from John, the commissioning editor for religion, who would look at these various pious programs on the other channels and says, oh, this religion is simply bonkers, darling. It's nonsense. But much to my astonishment, people started writing to me after my first series on St. Paul and saying now they felt they could go back to church.
Right.
And I thought, well, how? What did I do wrong? I mean, haven't I conclusively shown that, in fact, the tenets of Christianity are not true, that Paul, not Jesus, was the first Christian.
But you also found yourself to be very drawn to the person of Paul. And weren't you surprised yourself at what you discovered there?
Yes, because when I was offered this job, and I thought, right, now here's my chance to get at St. Paul, because I held him responsible for so much of what had gone wrong in Christianity.
Women keeping their heads covered in church.
Women, exactly. And also, he'd perverted the loving doctrine of Jesus and made it all into something intellectual and mystical and doctrinal and harsh. And found, of course, when I started to look back into the actual evidence. And I had a very fine New Testament scholar as a consultant who was very tough with me, and I needed him to be tough with me because I didn't know much at that stage. And I found that this just the evidence didn't match up to that. A lot of the epistles that are attributed to St. Paul in the New Testament are not written by him at all.
Right, and some of them don't even claim to be. When you actually read the text, it's interesting,
exactly,
isn't it?
They're just lumped together with St. Paul. And some of the most misogynist, anti-female sayings are not not written by St. Paul at all. Mm-hmm. He was a much more egalitarian. And it was a program that I had to follow in his footsteps more or less. We went round and I was standing in places where he'd stood. I became very close to him because there's a great passion about those writings. He was a genius, and geniuses are not always easy people or even very pleasant people. But there was a huge vulnerability about him in the second letter to the Corinthians, where he's pleading with the Corinthians and saying, you know, why don't you like me, basically? What have I done wrong? And how he says what a bad speaker he is. That's always astonished me, and I always assumed he was a very good orator. You know I don't speak well. You know I'm not physically, impressive like some of the others. And a real cri de coeur, but also the genius of the man, because he did take this sorrowful tale of Jesus and brought the whole richness of the monotheistic tradition into the Gentile world, able to package it brilliantly for the Gentile world. And so even though he was Jewish, Jesus was Jewish, they really, he was able to make that teaching of Israel accessible to Gentiles. And he was creating this entirely new religion, absolutely on the run, sort of constantly on the road, travelling, in prison, because he was a pugnacious man and always sort of in trouble one way and another. And he was a genius. I found myself, much against my will and much to my surprise, immensely moved by him. And maybe some of that came out in the series.
Say some more about how your impression of his role in relationship to Jesus' role in beginning the church changed. I think it's interesting the way you phrase that.
Well, Jesus, as far as we know, had no intention of founding a new religion. And he was Jewish and even says in the Gospels he's come only for the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Paul had never met Jesus. What he had was vision. He had some kind of vision of the risen Jesus that said that this was to go to the Gentiles.
On the road to Damascus.
Well, that's the story. That's a later story in the Acts of the Apostles. Paul himself simply calls it an apocalypse, a revelation.
Okay.
Perhaps an intense visionary moment.
So Paul himself doesn't refer to Damascus, is that?
No, he
I
doesn't.
I didn't know
that's
that.
That's in the Acts of the Apostles, written not by St.
Not
Paul.
Not by him.
But probably by one of his followers.
Oh, okay.
It was years probably after his death.
Okay.
And he himself talks about his own career in the Epistle to the Galatians, where he refers to this moment of revelation, but that's all he says about it. Mm. Basically, what he did was to make Jesus into a myth. And that I mean that in the most reverential sense. We've lost the sense of myth in our modern scientific world. We think a myth is something that didn't happen. But a myth is a timeless truth. A myth, strictly speaking, is something that happened in some sense once, but which also happens all the time.
Yes.
And Paul brought the sad tale of Jesus dying a disgraceful death on a cross and brought it into the life of ordinary Christians by means of the rituals of baptism, by means of the breaking of the bread. And it was, in fact, the Gospels were all written by people who, in one way or another, had converted to St. Paul's version of Christianity, the meaning of St. Paul's version. His are the earliest Christian writings that we possess.
And this was all new to you.
It was completely new. I mean, we'd done a little ladylike theology in the convent, but we'd left out the really challenging stuff. And this whole idea that Paul was, in some sense, the founder of Christianity, inspired by Jesus, passionately in love with a Jesus whom he'd never met, but bringing the whole richness of the Jewish tradition, especially its teaching on compassion and love. Paul's epistles, the ones he actually wrote, are overflowing with affection for people. And, of course, it is Paul who says, you know, that you can have faith that moves mountains, you can give your body to be burnt as a martyr, words that have terrible resonance with us these days, of course. But if you lack charity, it's worth nothing at all. And here he's in line with all the great major teachers, whether it's Confucius or Buddha or the Upanishads or the prophets of Israel, that what makes religion and what brings you into the divine presence is not spiritual gifts, not martyrdom, but the practice of charity, compassion and kindness to all.
Now, wasn't it in retracing Paul's journey that you went to the Holy Land for the first time?
Yes, I was working with an Israeli film crew.
Yes.
It was a very funny project because we had absolutely no money. We made it for $100,000, the whole thing, six parts. But it was wonderful fun. Very important things. Here, for the first time, I encountered Judaism.
Yes.
And Islam. Now, I was ashamed to find that through my religious life had been entirely Christian. And now it seemed terrible that I had merely thought of Judaism as a kind of prelude to Christianity, later discredited. And I'd never given Islam a thought. But when you're in Jerusalem, where you see these faiths jostling often uneasily at the same sacred sites, you become aware of the profound connections between them.
When are we talking? Is this the
1982,
83. Okay.
83.
And I will say that reading your book, I mean, you are now, I know that you call yourself an untrained or self-trained theologian, but you are considered to be one of the world's great experts on these religions. But when you went there, you really knew nothing.
No thing.
And you were very up for straightforward about that.
Yes. No. I was learning on the job. I mean, and yeah. I have learned. I was. That's how I'm entirely self-taught. I think that gives you a bit of an advantage because, in one way, I'm an amateur, and an amateur, the word literally means one who loves. I haven't done, because I haven't imbibed the correct jargon or anything. I know because of my own difficulties and struggles without a teacher, really, how difficult some of these ideas are to. I can probably share this with people who read my books a bit more and help them to see how I got into things.
Yeah.
But I didn't know anything about at all. And there was a wonderful moment when I actually went and asked for some help from a Jewish scholar at a college where I later, much to my astonishment, found myself as a teacher for some years. And he explained to me, for example, the revolutionary idea that religion was not about belief, about believing things. He was telling me the story of Rabbi Hillel, the older contemporary of Jesus, who'd been approached by a bunch of pagans who said they would convert to Judaism if Hillel could recite the entire Torah while he stood on one leg. And Hillel stood on one leg and said, "Do not do unto others what you would not have done unto you. That is the Torah. The rest is commentary. Go and learn it." And I said, "Well, that's all very nice, but I mean, what were these Gentiles supposed to believe?" Mm-hmm. And Chaim said, "Well, it's easy to see you were brought up Christian." He said, "We Jews, it really doesn't matter what you believe. Religion is about doing things. It's about, say, living, as Hillel says, in a compassionate way that changes you." Mm-hmm. And the more I started going into all this, the more I saw that certainly that was true of Judaism. Certainly it was true of Islam, whose cardinal practices are not a whole list of beliefs to which you have to subscribe, but rather you have to fast during Ramadan, you have to go on pilgrimage, you have to pray facing Mecca several times a day. In other words, orienting yourself, teaching your body in the prostration of prayer, the humility and surrender that is required of the act of Islam or submission to God. You give alms. These practices that are designed incrementally over the years to change your inner world. Now, this was completely revolutionary to me in one way, but I could also see that this was rather like the training we had in the convent, where every one of these practices during the day was seen as a possibility for an encounter with God.
Right.
And if you look at the Gospels, in fact, there's very little about doctrines as we later know it. I mean, Jesus does not go around discoursing about original sin or the Trinity or the fact that he's the Son of God incarnate, second person of the Trinity,
no,
or
he's
who the Holy Ghost
eating
is.
With sinners, isn't he? He is healing people.
He is going out to people who are regarded as beneath contempt, mm-hmm. or as traitors to their country, or as irreligious people, or sinners. He sees all and saying that everybody is welcome, telling people that they've got. He himself, like Paul, is a bit pugnacious as far as we can see too, but definitely he had that. You know, that again, it's about doing things, healing, helping. Rather than expounding a lot of doctrines, change your life, change your behavior.
And you pointed out, I mean, I think it's easy to forget in this country, Jesus was Jewish.
Yes.
From the tradition you had just discovered that valued practice over ideas.
I know. And of course, once you start looking at the gospel sayings alongside the sayings of Jesus in the Talmud of the early rabbis, you see Jesus as very deeply embedded in the Jewish world. You know, he himself teaches a version of Hillel's golden rule, but he says, do unto others as you would have done unto you. And many of his sayings resonate with the sayings of the great rabbis of this time, that you'll find in the Talmud. So he was very much involved in that world, and of course we miss Jesus. We don't get the point of Jesus unless we really appreciate our profound roots. This was a religion that had that went in three ways.
Right. And I think I'm just as we're speaking, I mean, you have come to be someone who has that large perspective of the three monotheistic traditions, and really, it's occurring to me. I mean, you discovered them together, also.
Yes, I did.
Which made from the beginning, yeah.
And in fact, it was because I did other religious programs too, where I had to, like you, interview people, religious people. And that meant I had to hastily find out about what they were supposed to be believing and doing and thinking, and what Sufism was, what Islam was, what Buddhism was, and putting myself through a bit of a crash course in that. And it was actually the study of these other traditions, the study of Judaism, the study of Islam, the tremendously rich traditions with its immense complex and inspiring mysticism, for example, and also Greek and Orthodox, Greek-Russian Orthodox Christianity. I mean, it's very different from our Western forms of Christianity, and much more mystical, and actually much closer to religions such as Buddhism than we are in the West. And so all this was actually teaching me that there were many things in religion that I just hadn't taken on board in my convent years, in my early years, and that I could really relate to. But also, it wasn't that I wanted to convert to any of these faiths particularly, but it also helped me to see my own differently, my own tradition, where I'd started from, differently. And I could see what my own Catholic tradition had been trying to do at its best, once you saw it in the context of these other faiths, and saw, ultimately, the profound similarities between them. That, you know, working in isolation from one another often, and often in a spirit of deadly hostility with one another, still Jews, Christians and Muslims had continually over the centuries asked many of the same questions about God, spirituality, prayer, ethics and come up with remarkably similar solutions. So that this tells you something about what kind of human beings we are, what we are as humans, how we behave when we're confronted with the absolute, and what brings us into enlightenment.
Mm. I'd like to talk some more about your discovery of Islam. I think, again, in the beginning, you weren't even aware that Muslims take their spiritual lineage from Abraham. Is that right?
No,
very new to this.
I was exactly. I was absolutely ignorant. I knew nothing, and I was taken up to the temple. What the Jews call the Temple Mount, which the Muslims call the most noble sanctuary, the Haram al-Sharif. And there I was shown the Dome of the Rock, that with a great golden dome, which has a big rock in the middle of it. And on this rock, I was told Abraham is thought to have sacrificed his son. And I realized that Abraham is a great prophet, and it had to be explained to me that not only Abraham but Moses, Jesus, Adam are all revered as great prophets in Islam, that you cannot be a Muslim and deny the truth or taught by Jesus and Moses and Abraham. That your Islamic spirit must include an appreciation of these other traditions. Astonishing to me that this was so. And then I found later in the Sufi tradition that it was quite common for a Sufi mystic, the Sufis being the mystics of Islam, to cry in ecstasy that he's no longer a Jew, a Christian or a Muslim. He's at home equally in a synagogue, a mosque, a temple or a church, because when one has touched the divine, one can leave these man-made distinctions behind. Mm. I mean, all this was wonderful to me. I was just inspired by it. But instead of seeing other traditions as, at best, a mistake, but to see them as positively and as enriching, that gave me a blueprint, as it were, for delving into these other traditions and drawing what nourishment I could from them.
It sounds like also when you then took up to write a life of the Prophet Muhammad, somewhat similarly to your experience with Paul, you really had sort of a love affair with this person. You loved him and wrote, and was it one Pakistani scholar said to you, your book is a love story?
Yes, he said it's a love story. He also went on to say that if I had known the prophet, I would have consented to become his 15th wife. I'm not sure that's actually the case. But yeah.
Tell me about that. What did you come to love in the Prophet Muhammad?
The fact that he's extremely human. We know more about him than we know about almost the founder of almost any other major tradition, because he's so much later than Jesus, say. And so there's more information, more documentation. And his first biographers are really trying to write history. It's not history as we know it in the 21st century, but it certainly presents the prophet warts and all. It doesn't attempt to whitewash him. It shows him sometimes having awful trouble with his wives, who were not entirely an unmixed blessing. People often assumed that Muhammad had a wonderful harem and was basking decadently in a garden of sensual delights. Not from it. Far from it. I mean, the wives were often a headache. And undertaken for political reasons, but also you see him struggling. He was living in a violent and desperate, brutal society, and he managed to bring peace to that world by not by force, but actually. He, for 5 or 6 years, he and the Muslims were fighting a war against Mecca, which was the Meccans were going to exterminate the little Muslim community. Muslims were fighting for their lives. But he won, not by violence, but by eschewing violence. And for 2 years, practicing a campaign of non-violence that's not dissimilar to that practiced by Gandhi or other inspiring, peaceable rulers. And you see his vulnerability. You don't often see Jesus laughing in the Gospels. In fact, I think you almost never do. You often see Muhammad playing with his grandchildren, putting little Hassan and Hussein on his shoulders and running round with them, weeping over his death of a friend, comforting his daughters. And you, like Paul, you sense the vulnerability of the man, striving and sweating literally with the effort as he uttered the words, beautiful words of the Quran, that because the Quran doesn't come out well in translation, but the Arabic, I'm told, is just of surpassing beauty.
Yes. And Muslims respond to that beauty at a spiritual level that I think it's not accessible to the rest of us. But it's part of their experience.
And I was talking to a Muslim scholar only the other night who was saying, who was asked, what would be the essence of Islam if you could? And he said, oh, the Quran. That without the chant, without the beauty of that scripture, which is a sonoral, it is something that is heard and listened to. The word Quran means recitation. So it's not something you sit and read to yourself silently. It's something you listen to. And with its beauty, Muhammad was one of the great a prophet, but also a poet and a statesman. And all this was sort of wonderful to me. I felt close to him, inspired by him. Since in recent years, of course, with the horrors that have been perpetrated in the name of the tradition that he founded, he would have been so shocked, appalled and devastated to see what has been done.
And, you know, you say that. I think you have a gift for connecting with people of ideas over time. You know, I remember when you talk about discovering Tennyson, you say he was closer to me than many of my living contemporaries. And I feel like you achieve that kind of connection with St. Paul and with Muhammad. So when you make that kind of observation about Muhammad, I want to listen to it.
Well, I early on had a great gift in that I was reading a very scholarly and wonderful book about Islam in three volumes, and I lit upon a footnote that explained in very dry academic language what a religious historian was supposed to do. I think they assumed it would be a he rather than a she, was supposed to practice what was called the science of compassion. Now, science is used here in the sense of scientia, knowledge. So it was a knowledge acquired by compassion. And compassion, of course, doesn't mean feeling sorry for people, pitying people. Compassion, compathein, it means to feel with. And in this little footnote, he said, the author said that you must not leave the discussion of a religious idea or a theology or a personality such as Muhammad and look without being able to find out what lay at the root of this, not to dismiss these ideas out of hand from the superior viewpoint of post-Enlightenment Western rationalism. Right. But to divest yourself of that rationalistic outlook and enter the minds of these mystics and sages and poets, and not to keep on asking, but why, and filling out with scholarly knowledge the background until you come to the point where you can imagine yourself feeling the same or believing the same as them. Until basically the intellectual idea learns to reverberate with you personally. And that I immediately took as my watchword, so that because religion is not about a list of doctrines or a list of practices. You can't study a religion like Islam simply by learning off the five pillars of Islam and the date of the prophet and the major forms of, you know, what are the differences between the Sunnis and the Shiites. The thing will remain opaque to you until you learn to feel what all these doctrines mean. The same with Christianity, the same with Judaism, the same with Buddhism. And that was the sort of I copied out this this footnote and put it on the notice board that at that time was behind my desk and tried to read it every day and remind myself that that's what I'm trying to do.
It occurs to me that this question, but why, is which you ended up posing as your method as a theologian, is the question you couldn't ask in the convent those years ago.
Yes, that was the case.
Yeah.
And we were also feeling was rather discouraged in those days because we weren't supposed to form friendships, and I was always being told I was too sensitive and too emotional. I was. I wept throughout my religious life like a broken water spout. I was sort of in a state of great tension, I think, and worry and anxiety, as many of us were. And I cried a great deal. And I was told I had to pull myself together. Fair enough. But that didn't mean that strong feeling was therefore have been eschewed. I mean, I think I had to educate myself emotionally because emotionally I was rather retarded. And I did that mainly by means of literature, by learning to feel with people like Tennyson, and later learning to feel with St. Paul, feel with Muhammad, with
right.
Jesus, and later with the Buddha.
And I think your own passion for these ideas and for learning about them, for asking the questions about them, seems to connect with the passion that these figures had and brought into the world.
Well, I think you miss the essence of these people if you imagine them just sitting uttering a list of doctrines. And our theology, I think, should be like poetry, like the work, like
yes,
the Quran.
Yes, you say that. That's such a lovely thought. Say some more about that.
Well, you see, I think theology is poetry. That's what my Jewish friend Chaim Maccabee told me all those years ago when he quoted Hillel's Golden Rule to me and said, you know, it doesn't matter what you believe. Theology is poetry. Now, a poet spends a great deal of time listening to his unconscious and slowly hauling up a poem word by word, phrase by phrase, until something beautiful is brought forth, we hope, into the world that changes people's perceptions. And we respond to a poem emotionally. And I think we should take as great a care when we write our theology as we would if we were writing such a poem. Instead of just trotting out an orthodox formula or an orthodox definition of God or a catechism answer, or just we should be so that when people listen to a theological idea, they feel as touched as when they read a great poem by, say, Milton or Dante. And we should take as great care with our religious rituals as if we were putting on a great performance at a theatre. And because the ritual and theatre, indeed, was originally a religious ritual designed to lead us to transcendence instead of just mechanically going through the motions of our various rites and ceremonies, trying to make them into something absolutely beautiful and inspiring. Because I do see religion as a kind of art form. There's a wonderful moment when one of my favourite Greek Orthodox theologians, a man called Gregory of Nyssa, who was fourth century, wonderful mystic. And he and his brother and friend were the people who formulated the Eastern Orthodox doctrine of Trinity. And he said, first of all, this doctrine could only be understood in a ritual context and in the context of prayer and contemplation. It's not something like an equation that you can just follow rationally. It makes sense only in a context of ritual and prayer, like any great religious idea. But he said, I think of the three, he said, I think of the one. When I think of the one, I think of the three. And then my eyes fill with tears and I lose all sense of where I am. And that's what a theological formulation of the Trinity should do to us. And so often our theological formulations don't do that to us. They remain opaque and a bit soulless. And but I think we should be a bit more creative and inventive with our theology.
It feels important to me also that, you know, in our time, especially since September 11th, people are often wondering aloud, how can the three monotheistic traditions in particular, or all religions, I mean, we can look around the world and see religions seeming to be at the root of violence and conflict and trouble. And when people ask, what do the religions have in common, they often look to see what ideas religions have in common or what doctrines. But where you end up with all of your study of the many religions, and you've also written A Life of Buddha, you end up with the litmus test of compassion. So this action rather than this idea.
Yes, yes. That the religions are forms of ethical alchemy, if you like, that you behave in a compassionate way and this changes you. Why? Because all the great masters of religion tell us that what keeps us from a knowledge of the divine, from which has been called variously God, Buddha, Nirvana, God, Nirvana, Brahman, the sacred, what keeps us from this ultimate reality is our own egotism, our greed, that often needs to destroy others in order to preserve its sense of self, or even just to denigrate others.
And we see that also happening in the name of religion.
We do. I'll just finish. We'll come back to that in a minute because that's important.
Okay.
But let's just stick with this. What compassion does is to make us dethrone ourselves from the center of our world and put another there. And it's this that they all teach leads us into the presence of the divine, gives us an apprehension of the divine, not believing in creeds, not undertaking weird penances, but it is this doctrine of compassion. Buddha said that the practice of compassion can introduce you to nirvana. Jesus said that on the last day, it's those who have been sick, who visited people who are sick, naked, hungry and in prison, have looked after them, who will enter the kingdom of God, who come into the divine presence. Not those who have the correct theology or the right sexual ethics, for example. And so I think that is the test, that compassion is the key. And they've all come to this conclusion, not because compassion sounds good, it sounds nice, but because it works, that we are at our most creative when we are ready to give ourselves away. And we're at our most sterile and dangerous when we seek to have ourselves and more so, and to use religion, indeed, to enhance our sense of ego.
Right.
And this is the danger, because a lot of times I say this to religious people and they often look rather mutinous and balked, because what's the fun of being religious if you can't complain about other people or denigrate other people, hate other people, or even in its worst possible formulation, kill other people? One of the things I've been finding recently in my studies is that every single one of these major traditions that continue to nourish humanity all began in extremely violent societies. They all came to birth in times like our own, which are filled with violence and when society seemed to be crumbling. And all of them took a position against violence.
At their root, tried to find what
lay at the core of this, which is largely egotism, fear, greed, and hatred, and hatred is a form of ego, and to relate deeply to this, and to the extent. They were deep and profound, these religious traditions, to the extent that they eschewed violence. However, a lot of people come into religion and they don't want to lose their egos, frankly. They're quite happy with
themselves. Well, it's a hard thing for human beings.
It's very hard. It's unpopular. And when the Buddha, for example, was wondering whether he should teach his message after enlightenment, he said, no, it's going to be too upsetting and disappointing, because people really don't want to lose their egos. Mm. And they're not going to therefore understand what I'm saying to them. And also because these religions were all operating in times of great violence. That violence in the surrounding world sometimes seeps into the scripture. So we have it in our Bible, for example. On one page, God is telling us not to kill, and then on a few pages later, we find God telling the people of Israel to wipe out all the inhabitants of Canaan. Mm. Jesus in the New Testament tells his followers to turn the other cheek, not to attack, and to forgive and love. And then return to the book of Revelation, where Jesus is leading armies and destroying the enemies of God in battle with great gusto. Same with the Quran. There are moments when Muhammad is the general telling, you know, you've got to fight hard. You've got to fight the enemy wherever you find them, as any general has to do. But ultimately forgiveness is better. Ultimately, if the enemy seeks peace, you've got to lay down your arms immediately. So there's always that violent element is in all our scriptures. It's in all our traditions. And what happens when we look around the world in many of these conflicts, it's not that religion has sparked these traditions. It's rather that violence has become endemic in a region and religion has got sucked into that vortex of violence. The Arab-Israeli conflict began on both sides as a secular conflict about a land, a typically secular conflict. Zionism was originally a secular movement, a secular revolution against religious Judaism. And the PLO was essentially secular liberation ideology. But then the thing festers on and religion has sadly and horribly got sucked in. We're seeing the same in the violent world of Iraq today, a country that has been brutalized. We see it in Afghanistan, which has been a theater of war for decades and where violence is king. War, after all, and violence affects everything that we do. If we are engulfed in a war, it affects our dreams, it affects our fears, it affects our personal relationships, it affects everything, our art, and so it's going to affect our religion too. And I think that you'll find that that's been the pattern with most of the religious violence of our time. And the lesson is, let's settle disputes while we can, while they're still secular and therefore capable of a pragmatic solution, before they fester, become sacralized, and therefore the issues have become absolute. Because we can use, say, God horribly, simply to endorse our own fears and loathings and hatred and make God into a sort of slogan and basically into an idol whom we've created in our own image, just endorsing our side and seeing everybody else as evil. And then you get horrors like September the 11th. You get the atrocities of the centuries ago of the Crusades.
Right.
Because people are not disciplined enough in realizing that God is not just a bigger and better version of ourselves writ large with our likes and dislikes, but a reality that is entirely different.
I think that this core virtue of compassion that you describe, that you find in religious traditions, and I think, you know, let's be honest, the violence makes headlines, but many, many people live with this virtue or struggle to live with this virtue as they live out their religious lives. It's especially tested in our time in an interesting way, I think, by the clash between people within religions, between people who are more fundamentalist, who we associate with using violence in the name of religion, co-opting religion to that end, and those who feel that their religion has been co-opted and taken away. It's hard to apply that virtue of compassion to people who seem to be abusing their religion. I mean, where do you see this virtue of compassion playing into this very real dynamic of how religion gets divided? Yeah.
I think we've all got to make an individual decision. All those of us who are religious in one way and another, we don't have to wait for a leader or a prophet to come along to look at our scriptures and reclaim them from the bigotry or the ignorance that has taken root in so many and insecurity and reclaim the compassionate ethos which lies at their very root. And there are so many religious issues, not just religious terrorism. We're looking at, say, at child abuse in the Catholic Church. We're looking at, as you say, the clash between the liberals and fundamentalists, which is a divide in every tradition. First of all, I think so Christians, for example, have got to take Jesus seriously when he says, "Love your enemies." Are these some of the few words?
Oh, don't be ridiculous.
Yeah. What do you mean?
I know what you're saying. It's so straightforward, but it's a very hard
command. Of course it's hard. Yeah. But what it means is not that we've got to be filled with soggy compassion for Osama bin Laden, but that we've got to wish people well in situations where there is no hope of return. Where we've got to extend our benevolence to places where we know we will not get a return. And it's hard. But in that, I am convinced we'll come to apprehensions of the divine if we make that effort. Because if we do what Hillel says, he was right. It was such a profound statement. Do not do to others as you would not have done to you. If we live by that day by day, hour by hour, minute by minute. And it's no good going straight on to Osama bin Laden or Saddam Hussein and all the rest of it. Well, there are people in our own immediate entourage who we find difficult to get on with. The Buddha always said you have to radiate compassion to all four corners of the world, but you've got to deal first with the people who are right up there around you. That difficult sibling, that annoying colleague, that rival, your ex-wife or whatever, until you can extend benevolence, you wish them well, this starts to break down the hard shell of ego. If you said every time you attempted to say something horrible about one of these enemies, one of these annoying colleagues, siblings, etc., or a country with whom we're at war, how would I like this said about me or mine? And in that moment, refrained. In that moment, we would have achieved a transcendence of ego. And that would be a religious life. I think as Hillel was right to say, that's the essence of religion. That's the Torah. The rest is commentary. Confucius uttered a version of this golden rule 500 years before that. As we see, Jesus taught it. Buddha taught a version of it. Because that we don't have time then anymore to worry about the existence of God because then I'm convinced we get intimations of the divine. If we lay aside that frightened ego and try and extend our benevolence, try and see things from other people's point of view, look into our hearts and find what it is that pains us, and then make sure we don't inflict such pain on other people, whoever they are. Discipline for life.
I wonder if you would tell a story that you told when you and I were on a panel together several months ago. It was a simple story, but I haven't been able to stop thinking about it. You described being on part of another discussion, and a fundamentalist Christian, I believe, beginning to rant and rave. Do you remember this?
Yes. I was at Oregon State University, and it was a conference called God at 2000, and it was a wonderful conference. We had lectures from Jews, rabbi, a Muslim scholar. There was freelance monotheist me. There was Diana Eck, who's an Indologist but is also a devout Christian. And we were all asked to say what we had learned about God. And it was wonderful. People were asking profound questions about the nature of prayer, spirituality, listening to very, very religious ideas. Very pluralistic ideas were coming out that nobody thought that their tradition alone had the right answer, the monopoly of truth. And then when we were on the final panel, suddenly erupted in the hall a fundamentalist who started to shriek at us incoherently. what I could make out was that he was saying that Jews and Muslims had denied Jesus, and therefore they were going to hell. And all of those of us who sided with Jews and Muslims and were also going to hell. And this was evil, and you couldn't hear much. Because he was so incoherent with rage and despair. What I could hear, however, was the note of pain in his voice. This was not just some loony. This was somebody who was suffering and in pain and felt profoundly threatened by what we were saying. And the point is, though, that we, seven of us on this panel, we're all articulate people. We'd all been talking non-stop to each other and to the audience for the last 2 days. We were utterly struck dumb. None of us could say a word. We felt utterly winded by this assault. Even me, and I should have known better because I'd just finished my book on fundamentalism, I couldn't think of anything to say. And we were looking at one another over an abyss. A massive abyss. Eventually, this man was hustled out. And the moderator said, well, I wish we could have talked to him. Mm-hmm. Because he is part of the conference of God. Where is God at 2000? He's part of this conversation. But somehow we couldn't talk of one another. He was incoherent. We were struck dumb and useless. And this is the problem that we're facing, right, in a nutshell.
It says something about the limits of words and dialogue.
Yes.
Over this abyss, doesn't it?
It does. And I think what we've got to do is listen to the pain of the other. We've got to listen. You could hear the note of pain. You know how people sometimes rant on and you can hear the distress in it. It's almost like a note in music. And we've got to, when we look, say, at fundamentalist doctrine, we've got to see what pain and fear lies at the root of this. Learn to decode fundamentalist ideology so that we see the pain at its root. They've got to try and listen to us too, but that's their business. We've got to take the initiative, I think, or you know, I think so, and start to listen to what they're trying to say. Because as we've learnt to our cost, they're trying to express, often very badly and in noxious ways, anxieties and fears that no society, no government can safely ignore. And so our future, I think, depends on learning to listen. Now, it's maybe too late. I have no easy solution for this because I don't hear a great deal of pain and fear in Osama bin Laden. I think that this has moved on now and has stopped being fear and distress in some parts of the world, only in a tiny minority. But we saw on September the 11th, that it only takes a very few people to commit immense havoc these days. 19 people with pen knives and box cutters. So even though it's only a tiny minority, that is hardening into rage and implacable rage and righteousness. And the same is happening too in the United States in the Christian fundamentalist world too. There are Christian fundamentalists in this country who've gone way beyond the moral majority and Jerry Falwell and who've gone into something quite different. And more implacable. And it may be impossible to get that back. But with the fundamentalists in our own ranks that we come in contact with, and we've got and fundamentalists worldwide, we've got, for our own survival, to seek to understand the pain that lies at its root. That doesn't mean, of course, that we condone evil actions like terrorism or killing,
right,
not at all.
You're still
But unless we try and understand it, we're all lost because we've got to have accurate intelligence in our campaign against terror.
And you're really back at that virtue of compassion again.
Yes, yeah. It means to feel with, to feel with, not to feel sorry for, but to say, if I were in his position, maybe I would feel the same. Maybe I would feel safe, but and then we've got caught up now in a spiral of violence where one atrocity leads to another atrocity, one strike leads to a counter strike, the other, and so we go on. Somehow we need to break this escalating cycle of violence. I have no solution other than compassion. But what we must do is reclaim religion and not let the terrorists or the extremists hijack our traditions from us. Bring back the compassion.
We have to finish, and I think I just want to ask you a couple more questions. Here's a large one, and then we'll come back to the personal. But there are many conversations we have in our world after September 11th, and we talk a lot about this fundamentalist threat and about the violence. I'd like to know if in all of the thinking you do and the traveling and speaking, is there some dynamic of religious experience, perceptions of religion in evolving in this post 9/11 world that we're not talking as much about that you'd like to name, something important?
Well, I do think, actually, in the United States, it's been very striking to me that people have wanted to understand this catastrophe in a religious way. Not just finding a quick secular solution, but in a religious way. And I also know that throughout the land, from sea to shining sea, there are all kinds of little initiatives springing up, interfaith initiatives, where local people are from different faiths are coming together. People are going to the mosque. The Muslim scholars that I know are endlessly circling round the continent, talking about giving lectures, talking about Islam. So something has broken open. And I think it could be a growth point. It could be a growth point. What has happened has been catastrophic and appalling and horrific. But I mentioned earlier that all the great world traditions grew up in times of violence and terror. Every single one of them, from those in China, those in India, and those in the Middle East. We've recently been looking at the horrific Roman violence of crucifixion in Mel Gibson's film. Whatever that one thinks of that film, it does show the violence that was part of Imperial Rome. And from that came these great traditions, that a moment of terror and fear and violence can lead people to say, we've got to do something different. We've got to find a new solution. We've got to look deeper into our traditions. And this could be a growth moment if we let it. If we let ourselves harden into attitudes of rage and despair and just vengefulness, then, you know, we'll lose our own spirit, and our own spirit will be damaged. But people are struggling with this in impressive ways, trying to find. I was so impressed that after September the 11th, Americans descended on the bookstores and snatched everything they could on
the
Islam.
Bookstores. That's right. And that lasted longer than descending on churches and mosques and synagogues.
These interfaith these interfaith moments, like that panel we were on a little while ago, are going on.
And I think one reason, perhaps, that people connect so much with your work is that, like you, perhaps not to the same degree, many people are becoming sort of amateur theologians in our time. They are educating themselves.
And why not? Mm-hmm. This is democracy, after all. And all the religions tell us, don't wait to be taught what to think by your leaders. Learn yourself. And see that the riches that are there, never mind what the official party line is, there's a lot more to all the traditions than that. A lot that can help us, even here in our very different world and frightening world where we're facing unprecedented problems. Each of our traditions has some deep wisdom to give us.
You know, even having read to the end of your memoir, I'm not exactly sure how you're going to answer this question. Do you now consider yourself to be a religious person? You?
Yes. Okay. Yes, I do. Okay. And I see my work, my study as prayer. And it is, and I've tried to describe that in the book, that's both its silence, the disciplines of the science of compassion, where you get out of your own preconceptions and try and enter the world of another. This changes you. And I love my work. I'm studying, I will sometimes have intimations of awe and wonder and transcendence. And some of my Jewish colleagues tell me that's exactly what Jews do when they study Torah and Talmud and immerse themselves in the sacred texts. So, yes, I am a religious person, and I'm still on a quest. I still haven't finished. Who knows where I will end up. But at the moment, I see my path as drawing great nourishment from other traditions, learning to absorb them, and trying to make the delight of my private study accessible to other people.
Well, I think that's your last word. This has been a really delightful hour. My producer's signaling me from across the glass, so I'm going to be quiet for a moment and listen to her.
Going to use T.S. Eliot's reading of Ash Wednesday, but yeah. We have 5 minutes. If she would like to read or recite Ash Wednesday for us.
Oh, heavens.
Do you hear, can you hear that? You can hear Kate's voice?
Yes, I can.
Do you
but
have
I'm
Ash Wednesday?
No,
with
I don't.
You? I do, but I
you
can't
do,
show it
but
to you.
But that's no good. Unless Sheila happens to have, my publicist happens to have one in her bag. I don't have one, I'm afraid.
We actually have an old LP of T.S. Eliot
That'd
reading his own poetry.
That would be
Isn't
much
that
better.
Amazing?
And, yes,
you know,
and he does it beautifully.
Oh,
he does it beautifully.
I wanted to say, I came, having been away from religion for a good 10 years, came back reading T.S. Eliot while I was living in England. These same lines.
Yes.
There's something amazing about them. It's also the poetry of Tennyson. I looked up In Memoriam.
Yes.
There's
yes.
some wonderful lines in there
absolutely.
That make
and
me
he
think
was,
of where you ended up, in a way.
And, you know, the ability to doubt, the voicing of doubt, and the fact that he was an epileptic, too, of course, is the great irony.
Yeah. Well, this has been lovely. Thank you. We will do an hour out of this, and I think we're going to turn it around pretty quickly, and we will send you that and let you know what's happening. And you may hear from my web person as he's putting the website together.
Thank you very, very much indeed.